We focus on Yugoslavia today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Donald Niebel has produced a beautiful book on Yugoslavian monuments. We'll ask how that came about on Scribble. This is the last thing I expected to find from a local author. Yugoslavian monuments. How did that come about, Don?
Well, I'd always been curious about Yugoslavia region. I'd been there a couple of years ago and seen a bunch of photographs online of these really unbelievably imaginative, abstract sculptures. And these are, you know, kind of the clickbait sort of photos you see pop up every once in a while. And for years, I'd just been fascinated, and I had an opportunity to go check them out about 3 years ago. And so I took some time, about 2-3 months, and spent thousands of miles just rambling around the landscape and trying to find as many as I could. And it was difficult back then because no one had really written anything about these things. I was kind of blazing a new trail, so to speak. And so I did this kind of pilgrimage, so to speak, back in 2015, and it just led me down this rabbit hole, which I continue to dabble in to this day.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it is astounding. When I opened the book, I thought, what is this? And I kept paging through, and I saw one amazing shape after another. This is not what we think of when we think of monuments in this country.
No, exactly. When most people think of World War II monuments specifically, they think of very kind of austere and restrained architecture and art that is kind of focused on morose and very kind of somber imagery. But these World War II monuments in Yugoslavia are just about the most imaginative, beautifully modernist creations that seem like something out of a dream almost, and almost seem futuristic, even beyond the years which they were built back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Wooten gave me the book this morning, so I hadn't seen it before, but you probably know what I was expecting when he said last week we're going to interview somebody that did a book on Yugoslavian monuments. So I asked everybody in the reading for the blind room where I hang out in the mornings. I said, when you think of Yugoslavian monument, what do you think? And everybody said the general on his horse with his sword drawn, right? There's not a general with a sword drawn in this whole book. How did this happen?
Yeah, well, I think that's the amazing thing, because these almost look as if they come from another planet. I mean, they are astounding.
But also, they're not apparently in good standing in Yugoslavia these days, right?
Well, it's a very kind of complicated.
It's incredible.
It's certainly a very interesting story about how this Southeastern European country back in the post-World War II era went from being this very Soviet-influenced country to this pivotal moment in 1948 when Tito, who was the president of Yugoslavia, had a falling out with Stalin. And basically at that point, 1948 onwards, there was basically a spurning of all things Soviet. And in this sort of atmosphere, the artists and artisans and creators in Yugoslavia decided, let's blaze a new trail of symbolism, of imagery, of what we are going to create to distinguish ourselves as a non-aligned state, essentially, because they were neither aligned with the Western powers nor the Eastern powers at this point. So they stood alone and wanted to create something to kind of embody that uniqueness that they were spearheading.
Well, they certainly did. I mean, this is unique. You look at some of these monuments and you think, how do they stand up? You know, some of them, there's one long, tall, vertical thing with a cluster around the middle. And I paged through it, page by page. I thought, what an amazing thing this is. Now, some of them appeared to be in disrepair.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you take these pictures yourself?
Yeah, other than the historical photos, obviously, I took all of the photographs in the book. I traveled around all of the former Yugoslav republics, even Kosovo, and yeah, spent about 3 years trying to track all of these locations down, to photograph them, and to compile them, and not just photograph them, but also research their history, which is really kind of dense, kind of material dealing with aspects of World War II that up until now haven't even really been written about in the English language. I mean, there was this whole theater of World War II in Yugoslavia that most people in the West don't even really consider or talk too much about in most historical circles.
Well, Yugoslavia itself is kind of a creature of the First World War, isn't it?
Yeah, it was one of the Versailles states, you could say.
You brought together people who are antagonistic, Croats and Serbs and so on, and Eastern Orthodox and Muslims, and yet under the iron rule of Tito, they got along just fine.
Well, you could say that they got along. Whether it was they were being forced to get along, that's a whole other story. But you could say Tito created this new Yugoslav identity, which hadn't really existed before. Because back during World War I, between World War I and World War II, when Yugoslavia first existed, there wasn't this idea of Yugoslavism. People were still Serbs, people were still Croats, et cetera, but in Yugoslavia, Tito worked hard to kind of cultivate this idea that you are no longer a Serb, you're no longer a Croat, you are something new. We are Yugoslavs, and he worked to create this identity centered around this new nationality, and these monuments, this art form that you see in this book is very much a part of that.
So was it Tito then that in his government that commissioned these?
Well, that's what a lot
because of, it didn't seem to me there was any difference between whether they were in Serbia or Croatia, you know, or anywhere. These are throughout the country. These are all alike.
A lot of people kind of have this misunderstanding that it was kind of a top-down sort of process where Tito said, this is what you're going to build, this is what you're going to build, when it was more sort of a kind of a shared responsibility where you had these government offices that encouraged certain artists to create certain things, but also they were very grassroots in the sense that these were often created by people in the local communities that had an attachment to the place where they were built, maybe even fought at that location, and maybe whose parents even died there.
Well, most of them were at scenes of battles and things like that.
Exactly, exactly. And they're located in these very remote places. And so they wanted it to be kind of not necessarily top-down, not necessarily bottom-up, but shared across the whole spectrum of responsibility from the very local to the federal system.
When you say they're all alike, Roel, they're alike in the fact that they're abstract and modern.
Right.
But boy, are they different. I mean,
well, but I mean, there are no generals on horses in any of these, or anything remotely like it. Right.
They don't resemble each other either. You can find some parallels there, particularly two things coming together, but everyone is unique and, I must say, dazzling.
Well, one thing that you mentioned earlier that was a common theme is you see many of the monuments that have this sense of defying gravity, that are reaching out, that seem like gravity should they're defying gravity.
Yeah, how do they stay up?
Yeah, exactly. Or it's very specifically engineered to appear like that. And that idea of defying gravity is certainly a part of their symbolism, because if you think about the creation of Yugoslavia, you have this ragtag team of rebels and resistance forces that took on the German army and all of the Axis forces of that time in a seemingly impossible feat. They defeated them at the end of the day. And so through these monuments, they are communicating this idea of triumph over seemingly impossible odds, defying gravity.
The name of the book is, I can see in it, Monuments and Database.
Yep.
What is the first
Spomenex? The title of the book is called Spomenec Monument Database. And okay. Spomenec is a word that comes from the Serbo-Croatian language that means monument or memorial. And it has come to, in this region and amongst people that are kind of enthusiasts of these monuments, the word Spomenec has come to kind of be fundamentally associated with these specific forms. They're so unique in themselves, the term World War II monument doesn't really do them justice. It kind of diminishes,
diminishes
how unique of a creation they are. And so people over the years who have been interested in them have applied this local word, the local word for monument, to these creations. And it's an interesting word actually in itself, Spomenec. Go ahead.
You say in your book that many of them have in fact been destroyed, and many of them have been abandoned, and there are cracks in the cement base and stuff. Why is that?
Well, after the fall of Yugoslavia in the process of the Yugoslav Wars in the 1990s and early 2000s, you had what was formerly a communist state of Yugoslavia, which fractured into various independent nations, which turned away from communism and more towards kind of nationalist identities. And in these new nationalist states, they had sometimes bitter and complicated relationships with these artifacts from their communist heritage. And so in many instances, these relics were kind of cast aside or forgotten about or became sort of unwanted reminders of a time that they wanted to forget. And as a result, many of these monuments, which were remote and secluded in the first place, just kind of got washed to the side.
That's a fractious place.
It is, yeah, even to this day.
I was going to say you spent 3 years.
I spent a number of months, probably 3 to 4 months each year over the course of 3 years, going back and meeting, not just visiting the sites, but meeting with locals, meeting with local researchers. And I even met some of the artists and sculptors who made some of these creations back during the era, which was a fascinating and amazing thing to do.
Was that a comfortable trip? Was the land still a little bit in upheaval, or what?
I mean, you could certainly feel, in some regions that there's still tensions left behind in some areas that are a little more contentious than others. But for the vast majority of the time, I had an incredible amount of fun, and it was very safe and a beautiful place to go, and people were even surprisingly good at communicating with me in English, because I don't speak Serbo-Croatian or any of the local languages myself, and rarely if I ever had a problem communicating or finding someone that I could communicate with.
So where did you do the research on these? Because each picture is accompanied by a description of where it takes place and why it takes place, who designed it, and the state of that it's in today. Where did you get all of that material?
Oh, I had to go through incredible amounts of not just books, libraries, not just here in the U.S., but also in the former Yugoslav states, and tons of archival research, research online, and trolling through databases and academic journals and articles. So it was a huge amount of work. It took me years to put all of it together.
The question occurs to me, why? Why, Don? Why did you want to do this?
Yeah, well, exactly. That's what I get from a lot of people, not just here in the U.S., but also in the region of the former Yugoslavia. When I was visiting and photographing and researching these sites, people locals would come to me and say, why are you wasting your time doing something like this? And people here in the U.S., you know, also said, why are you wasting your time looking at these strange, bizarre things? And for me, it was always just kind of like a project of passion. I saw this complete void of work and scholarly writing about this site. No, like, for me personally, it took months to be able to even just go over there the first time and find these things. I had tons of tragedies and situations that I ran into over there just trying to locate and track down many of these monuments. I would have hated for anyone to go through what I had to go through myself the first time. So I wanted to create something that someone who was curious could use, kind of like a manual or a guide, and go see these sites for themselves.
You have to be some kind of specialist on this.
Oh, no, not necessarily. I really don't have an art historian or a historical background as far as just really research. Like, I've done a lot of research in my life. I originally, or, you know, prior to doing this, I'd worked in various forms of the natural sciences doing a lot of research and landscape work as far as tracking down kind of doing forestry inventory, working for different governmental agencies. And I guess this fascination with finding things that are hidden in the landscape, which kind of was what I did before doing inventory in Oklahoma when I lived there, I was able to kind of recreate that in finding these hidden monuments in the landscape where previously they'd not really been documented or written about.
You're going to be asked to talk about this, aren't you?
I'm going over to London in a few weeks to give a couple speaking engagements there. And I have some planned for New York City as well in the coming months, and potentially even Berlin and Belgrade in October or this coming spring potentially. But lots of events planned in the future to give talks and lectures about this topic, yeah.
What about locally? There's a large Croatian community in the Quad Cities.
Yeah, well, that's – unfortunately, I've not had too many people reach out to me yet about this.
They don't know – I mean, I know nothing about any of this.
Yeah.
I think one thing that the Figge ought to do is have an exhibit of, you know, 50 of these photographs or something. These are really well-done photographs, and it's just going to blow people away.
The only objection I would make – is you certainly picked a sexy title, Spomonic Monument Database. I mean, that's not the sort of thing that calls out to you.
So how did the book get published?
Well, actually, I have a website that I started a couple of years ago just called Spomonic Database, and it was something where I kind of compiled all of the research I put together. And just out of the blue, this publisher out of London called Fuel Publishing and Design sent me an email out of nowhere and said, "We love this project you've put together. We are really fascinated by what you're doing, and we would love it if you collaborated with us to create a book out of everything that you've assembled." And so I said, "This sounds like a great opportunity. Yeah, well, let's work together and see what we can create."
You don't realize how many people we've talked to who are trying to get published, and here a publisher calls you and says, "Please, can I?"
Well, yeah, that let me know that I was onto something special. When
I,
you know,
I guess you are. I mean, this is a book that I would, you know, I've been showing it to people ever since this morning. Look at this, and nobody can believe it.
Yeah, that's the thing that gets me. This book is extraordinary. It's not merely beautiful, but I mean, it's an extraordinary book. And, you know, I don't know how you're going to sell Monument Database, but
where can we get a copy?
They're on pre-order already on Amazon, and they are being officially released, I think it is September 25th, somewhere around that
Okay.
Day. But the end of September is when the official releases in the U.S.
So are you going to have a local book signing and things like that?
I haven't got that planned specifically yet, but maybe I'll probably have to look into getting in touch with a local bookstore. So far, I've not heard from anyone yet, but I've not done a lot of local publicity. My publishers are in London, and so right. they've been doing a lot of stuff focused in Europe and New York City. But as of yet, I've not really had too many people kind of focusing on the local angle. My publishers are looking to – my local the American distributor that I'm working through is looking to get some speaking engagements more locally through the Figgy, but we've not heard back yet. So maybe in the future.
So you're just at the start of this whole thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a process that's been going on for many years, but right. In a way that's – yeah, you could say this is just the start.
You know, once this airs – that'll be September 8th. I would imagine local newspapers will want to talk to you because this is extraordinary. I mean, the idea that something this esoteric, specialized, is right here in the Quad Cities, the author lives here and has done this, and it is such a visual treat. You need a better title, eye blisters or something. I don't know.
How do you have time to do all this?
It's really almost a second job. I have a real job, my quote-unquote real job, and then in my spare time, I basically dedicate all of that to this project. And it's how, over the last few years, I've been able to assemble all of this material, assemble it into a book, into something that the publishers were ready to put their names on and
Donald Niebel, who was the author of Spumonic Monument Database. And if that doesn't sound like an appealing title, well, forget it. Just open the book, and that's all you need. It is an incredible visual treat, and the kind of information you don't think you need, but you will find it fascinating. Do you agree, Roald?
Oh, the pictures are spectacular. I had no idea. Uh-huh. That anywhere around there were this many monuments of this kind.
Yeah, well, I told him we're going to talk to an author about some Yugoslavian monuments. So that sounds like a real grabber.
But it is. It's incredible.
Thank you very much, Donald. We appreciate you taking the time. And this book had better sell because it is worth it, worth every bit of it.
Well, thank you so much, Don. I hope you have a great day, and I appreciate it.
You say you made a startling discovery in the book cover?
You unwrap the book cover and then unfold it, and there's a map of Yugoslavia with every one of the monuments in the book placed where they occur there. So what a neat idea for a book jacket.
Yeah, it is. That's just terrific. I couldn't believe it.
I don't know how you would find it. There's nothing in the book that says look in the book jacket. You just have to discover.
How many people would take off a book jacket and unfold it?
Well, somebody in the apron room this morning did that, because I never would have.
Yeah, that's amazing. This book is just astounding. I still can't get over it. But the guy on Yugoslavian monuments lives a block away from me. I never knew about it till someone on the Broadway internet thing said there's an author. And I thought, that's a strange-sounding book, but what the heck?
Yeah.
Let's, local author, let's give it a
shot. I had no idea what to expect, but it same as you, it just blew me away.
Yeah, well, it's a nice thing about a book. Sometimes it just startles you, either the content or in this, it's the pictures.
Yeah.
Although the research in it is fascinating.
Well, unbelievable.
Yeah, and that's not out yet. That's
be out next week.
Yeah, it'll be out toward the end of the month, but wow. Well, do you have any recommendations to make today?
Yeah, I've been binge reading books that Nan Carter sends me from Berkeley, all of them either Arabic or Egyptian or Palestinian or Lebanese or African. But one particularly strikes me as just, it's a kind of book I'm a sucker for. It's a book called Embrace on Brooklyn Bridge. And it's a very simple story in which a grandfather, whose name is Darwish, was Egyptian but has spent his life in New York as a successful professor of Arabic literature at New York University, has just retired and intends to move to a small cabin upstate New York. But meanwhile, he is about to give a birthday party for his granddaughter, who happens to be in the United States. She travels around the world between parents, celebrating her 21st birthday. Her name is Selma, and he's invited her to come to the party. And then he invites a whole series of other people to the party, former colleagues, former students of his, relatives, his own children, other, and the whole story deals with the plans for this party and the fact that everybody tries to get there and in one way or another somehow is thwarted or doesn't want to go and is forced to go. And it's simply the story of all the individuals who have been invited to the party who are trying to get there and in some way mess up, including the girl of honor, Selma herself, who misses the morning train, which will get her there in time for the party, which is to be at 8 o'clock. She will not get there until 1 a.m., a half hour after the party is over. So in the first place, the reason for the party is not going to be there. But all the other characters also have trouble. They're not used to the airlines. The trains aren't running on time. They get off at the wrong station. They dawdle and don't want to get there. It reminds me a lot of Virginia Woolf's Miss Dalloway, which the whole thing is Mrs. Dalloway planning a party that she's going to give that evening. It's like a prequel to the Canterbury Tales. How does everybody get to Canterbury? It really, really is well done. I can't tell you what happens at the end because there is a kind of a surprise ending. But it is just fun to watch all these people who, like many people who are driftless in the world, don't belong to any particular country. All of these characters, most of them are Egyptian originally, but many of them are world travelers. Many of them live in London or Oxford or, you know, Cambridge or New York or Detroit. They're rootless and mm-hmm. drifting, and they drift toward this one event, this party. Let me give you the name of the author. The title again is Embrace on Brooklyn Bridge. And the name of the author is Ezzedine, Ezzedine Fisher, Fishere.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he's a very well-known Egyptian novelist and who lives in this country.
It's interesting that you have this source of novels that come from other countries.
It's an endless source, and what it really reminds me that I've read five or six of them in the last 2 weeks. You know, cultural differences are huge, but just underneath the surface, people are people. You know, and whether you're a teenager in Palestine or a teenager in Detroit or a teenager in Nigeria, you're a teenager, right? And yeah. You have the same feelings and attitudes that teenagers have. Things underneath aren't very different.
Yeah, well, that's...
Fathers are fathers.
And books are books, and we'll be talking about them right. Every week at this time. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Don Wooten with Rural Tweet. We'll see you next week for another edition of Scribble.